It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Twins have had a unique place in many cultures for better and sometimes for worse. Tales of twins are found all throughout history, from the legend of Romulus and Remus founding Rome to the zany hijinks of identical twins switching places in movies like The Parent Trap. Twins are becoming more common these days with technologies like in vitro fertilization, but they're still rare enough to get a lot of attention. Our next guest is the ultimate expert on twins. He's written books about the cultural history of twins and directed a documentary called Twins on Twins. He's a twin himself, by the way. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a twin? Are there twins in your family? What's been your experience, either being a twin or maybe the parent thereof? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Full disclosure, I'm not a twin, but I'm a parent of twins. William Viney is a researcher and writer based in Rome. His newest book is called Twin Kind, The Singular Significance of Twins. Will, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, as I mentioned, you are a twin yourself. What is it that led from being a twin to having a lot of your research and writing focused on what it means to be a twin?
Look, I think actually it's a lot of ignorance and a certain measure of curiosity. I wanted to write this book because despite being a twin, being born a twin and not really having a choice about being a twin, I knew really nothing about them. And growing up, I was never really encouraged to think very critically about what it means to be a twin. And that carried on well into adulthood. And then when I looked around, I was like, well, there are no resources really to understand this category that I was born into. I was just, twins are just like a simple fact of life, something that you would kind of have to accept at face value. So I thought that there was some work to do there, at least, if nothing else, just to sort of educate myself.
Your introduction to the book is written by your twin brother, and he writes that you get a question kind of like one I got all the time. People would ask me, what's it like to be the parent of twins? You guys get asked, what's it like to be twins? I assume your answer is kind of similar to mine. Like, I don't know any different.
Look, it is. It's really, I don't. But I guess I over the last 10 years of becoming this kind of, am I a twin researcher? I suppose I am. A writer about twins. I've learned that what it is that people want to hear, right? They want to hear that you look alike. They want you to tell them that you're intimate with your twin sibling or that you hate each other. They want all kinds of stereotypes to either to be confirmed or to be denied. And I guess over the years, and I grow older, and I don't know, Rob, I don't know when people ask you about being a parent of twins, you get to learn the shape of those stereotypes. And I was really interested in my research to find out where some of those stereotypes come from.
And this fascination with twins is nothing new. The first chunk of your book is a survey of twins in mythology. And I kind of knew, I mentioned the Romulus and Remus thing, and you think Castor and Pollux, the Gemini siblings from ancient Greek mythology. Super common twin legends and folklore wherever you are in the world. Can you give us a sense of how common twins are in mythology?
Yeah, twin myths are often foundational to a community or to cities. Twins are often the firstborn beings in a cosmology, as they are in ancient Egyptian myths. They're the first men or women, and the first the gods put on Earth. They're sort of suitable heroes or kind of adventurers and explorers. Castor and Pollux, Heracles and Iphicles, Artemis and Apollo. These are not like minor figures in Greek and Roman mythology. They're kind of like the heavy hitters. And it really fascinated me to learn this because there's no class you go through. There was no class I went through to learn about twins and their impact on ancient civilization. So that was a wild ride.
In many cultures you write, everywhere from Africa to medieval Europe and elsewhere, the birth of twins was looked at something as being very bad, either saying something bad about the mother in many cases or an omen and not a good omen. How common is it to have the birth of twins be something bad, maybe even dreaded?
I mean, it goes back a little bit to this, these ideas of like foundational people. You know, in the Bible, we have Jacob and Esau. Their mother, Rebecca, is told that two nations struggle in her womb, and the brothers quarrel and argue, and Jacob deceives their father and wins the birthright, and the nations of Israel are born through him. Likewise, in Persian mythology and religion, you have these primeval good twin and bad twin kind of constantly at war with one another. How that happens, I don't know, but you find that very broadly. You mentioned medieval twin and twin beliefs. It was very common for a woman who fell pregnant and had twin and had twins to be accused of adultery. At least that's what we learn from court poetry and satires, and it was very common, therefore, to associate twins with adultery, a real big problem if you were a woman living in Christian Europe in the Middle Ages.
Talking to William Viney about his new book, Twin Kind, The Singular Significance of Twins. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experience as a twin or parent of twins yourself. Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Will, I want to give a listen to something that really set the modern standard of creepiness among twins. Here's a 1980s The Shining.
Play with us, Daddy.
So a chicken or the egg question here. Coming into The Shining, did people think of twins as creepy? Or coming out of The Shining, did that movie make people think of twins as creepy? How do you split the difference there?
I don't know, but we can look at the history of the image, you know, of the Louise and Lisa Burns, the British girls that played the twins. They're made up to look like a Diane Arbus portrait called Identical Twins, Russell, taken in New Jersey in 1966. And that picture is actually kind of cute and kind of interesting, and it's kind of freaky, but it's not scary. But I think what your listeners just heard, what you just played for us, the music and the sound of their voices. Now, there's quite a few elements there. And if you look at just what the Burns sisters look like on screen, I don't think that they look terribly horrifying, at least to me. But, you know, maybe I'm not a good judge of this after all these years of thinking about it. One thing is for sure is that we're showing these twins and they're never fully human. But they might be kind of, because they're twins, more than human. And that's the kind of horror of twinning that you find in other films too, that they're never simply one.
Now, something that's kind of horrible in real life, Will, we've heard over the years lots and lots of psychological and sociological research based on twins, comparing identical twins to fraternal twins, twins who grew up together to those who didn't. The origins of modern twin science came from some pretty dark places. And I didn't know this. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, you know, twins entered into a kind of industry of twin research towards the end of the 19th century with a man called British scientist, a man called Francis Galton. He also later on coined the term eugenics with twin research and with, you know, eugenics, the attempt to mold and develop ideal societies. You have a kind of a pairing to, you know, please forgive me, but you have the kind of pairing of twin research and eugenics. And during the 1920s and 30s, you have an explosion and development of twin research, not just in England, also in America, throughout Northern Europe, and in Germany under National Socialism. I think when I speak to people about twin research and their eyes widen and eyebrows raise and they think of twin research, they associate it with with Mengele. Joseph Mengele was who was a Nazi scientist and did horrific experiments at Auschwitz. Now, I think what I am very careful to do in the book, and I think that everybody should be aware of, is that twin science was completely normal at the time, and it continued to be completely normal after the war. And I was very fascinated to learn what happened to the careers of those scientists after the war. Some, like Mengele, disappeared into Latin America. Others continued in Europe, in Germany and elsewhere, as twin researchers. Twin research still involves about 1.5 million twins around the world. It's still big business.
Will Viney is with us, health researcher and writer. We're talking about his latest book. It's called Twin Kind, The Singular Significance of Twins. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from the twins out there, or maybe parents of twins. If you're living life as a twin, what are some of the most common questions people ask you? Maybe you're annoyed by those questions now, or maybe you love that people give a little extra attention. Are there weird misconceptions or stereotypes you come across? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about twins with William Viney, author of the new book, Twin Kind, The Singular Significance of Twins. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Harry is with us in Milwaukee. Harry, hello.
Well, hi. How are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I am the father of a set of twins and the uncle of a set of twins. And the one question that they always get is, which one of you is the evil one?
And Harry, as the parent and uncle, do you identify any of these twins as the evil one?
No.
Good.
They're both, but all three of them are lovely ladies.
A fine parenting decision. Harry, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. I'm guessing you've been asked this before, Will.
For sure. You know, I think, on the whole, people want you as a twin pair to represent a kind of nice set of contrasts, like we have the behavior or kind of psychology that a fairy godmother might give out. One's beautiful, one's less beautiful, one can do this, the other one can do that, one's good, one's evil, and it's a package, right? Twins get treated like packages. I think that the which one is the evil twin is very much part of that idea that twins form a whole.
Thanks for that call, Harry. Dot joins us now in Manitowoc. Dot, hi.
Hi. My brother and sister are twins, and my father always introduced them as the twin, and I was considered the baby. And for the longest time, I had wished that I would have been the triplet, because they got all the attention.
Oh, okay. Dot, thanks a lot for sharing that story with us. First of all, this idea of, will twins being identified, especially when they have other siblings, as the twins, there they are as a unit again.
Rob, what happens in your household? Do your twins get called the twins? Or is there a policy of avoiding it?
They were the only kids, so we were able to just say their names. I think sometimes, maybe in their friend group, sometimes they might have been referred to as the twins. But even that, I think, was pretty rare. But I feel like I run into this pretty often when there are like twins with other siblings. They're the twins.
That's for sure. And in some like parenting advice you see, and some of your callers might want to tell us their experience of this, that they're advised, parents are advised not to refer to their twin children as the twins, to try and give them some chance of forging a individual identity. I don't know what you make of that. I'm not sure either.
Our technical director, Sarah, is a triplet and says we were always referenced as the triplets. So there you go. So again, identified as that unit. Thanks. Thanks, Dot, for the call. Jeff is with us now in Appleton. Jeff, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell or ask about?
Well, I wanted to find out if there's been any research that shows how often twins might come down the family line. You know, I've heard every other generation and so on. The reason I ask is my mother's father, my maternal grandfather, he was a twin, and then he had twin girls, which were my aunts. And then my father's mother, my maternal grandmother, was a twin herself. But since that point, there's been no twins in our family on either side. And I now have grandkids, and my kids are not twins. None of my cousins have had twins, so it's skipping a couple generations. I want to see if there's any research along that line.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Do twins run in families well?
There's lots of research there, and my summary would be that it depends on what kind of twins we're talking about. When we talk about identical or what we might call monozygotic twins, they come from a single fertilized egg and they split into two identical parts. Those twins, what we know is that that's just a sort of wild biological phenomena. Only ever happens in armadillos. Armadillos have identical twins like that. Humans have twins like that. And we don't quite know why it happens. So that's monozygotic or identical twinning. When it comes to dizygotic or fraternal twinning, non-identical twins, there are lots of different theories, and also, you know, different twinning rates in different parts of the country and different parts of the world according to your ethnic and your ancestry. So it really depends, and it's and all like all things that are biological, it really depends on your environment, your diet, your age, all kinds of stuff. So it does sometimes seem to run in particular groups and sometimes families, but I don't have a conclusive answer on that one. I thought I'd share some of that information in case it's helpful.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. We're talking to William Viney about his new book, Twin Kind, The Singular Significance of Twins. Will, I want to take another stop in the history you share in the book here. A stretch in psychology suggesting that being a twin was inherently in some ways a psychological problem. What were we worrying about, especially in the middle of the 1900s?
Yeah, I think it comes out of the history of psychology, psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, that really based its models of human development on single people. You grew up, you know, according to Freud, you grew up as a young boy, loving your mother, hating your father, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you went through certain kinds of developmental stages. Now, twins, it seemed to these psychologists and psychoanalysts of the, say, 1950s and 60s, seemed to display, what should we say? They didn't seem to go through these patterns of development. And so what happened in the second half of the 20th century, that twins seemed to kind of become a bit of a problem. They seem to be a kind of a blockage towards becoming a kind of ideal individual. Now, I would kind of preface all this by saying this reflects a certain Western European and Northern American ideal of what it means to be a good individual and a good citizen. But for sure, twins were not celebrated necessarily among this psychological profession, shall we say.
From psychology to psychic phenomena. I used to tell my daughters, if just one of them was there, use your psychic link with your sister to see what she wants to order from the restaurant. It never worked. But a lot of people attribute psychic connections, paranormal connections between twins. You write that people actually tried to research this. Why is this such a stereotype? What has that research found?
Well, there seems to be a moment for scientists to take really seriously the prospect that particularly identical twins had a parapsychic connection and would set up serious experiments both in the laboratory and often with, it was tended to be observed among younger children in their homes to try and kind of capture that moment when they seem to share one another's pain or be able to communicate some kind of knowledge that they couldn't have possibly known without their twin helping. And that seems to have died out. Like, scientists have moved on from this. They signed a declaration to say that they all agreed there was no evidence, at least, for telepathic connections between twins. But like it doesn't seem to matter. This seems to be one of these interesting cases. It doesn't seem to matter what scientists say about that. The desire that people have for twins to have this sort of connection is still alive and well. And for some reason, people would love for me to feel the pain of my brother. I mean, I think that they're complete sadists, but you know what? You know, that's what people want from twins. Again, it goes back to why they're seen as kind of monstrous, that they're like not fully human, but maybe they're kind of more than human. You know, they're both monsters and they're kind of gods on earth. And this sort of extra power that twins may have, I think, is really exciting to people.
And just our last couple moments, Will, one part of your book I've been overlooking, the visual. You've got a lot of images from ancient mythological representations of twins to modern day pictures of twins from all over the world. Why was that visual side of storytelling important to you as you talk about twins?
I published a book a while ago on twins, and people were like, where are all the pictures? This one's got 400 images in it. It's really, really, really beautiful book. So tribute to the publishers for doing such a wonderful job. And I think that people want to look at you. You know, people ask me, you're a twin? And I say, yes. And then they say, let me see a picture. And I have to show them. It's like a way of giving evidence.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
William Viney is a health researcher and writer, and we've been talking about his newest book. It's called Twin Kind, The Singular Significance of Twins. Lots of pictures in there, as you heard. Hey, if you have a twin story to share with us, you can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Send pictures if you want to. It's not a requirement. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new report finds that households in the United States are paying 25% more for groceries than they did before the pandemic. That's more than what we've seen with general inflation. Our next guest dug into the numbers to uncover the root causes of why food prices have stayed high even as inflation has cooled down. She joins us now to share the findings, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Has the cost of groceries been a concern for you and your family? Are there particular items you've noticed going up and maybe staying up? Have you made changes to the kinds of meals you eat, the brands you buy to make your food budget work? Do you receive food assistance like SNAP or WIC? If so, has that been enough to keep up with the cost of groceries where you live? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Elizabeth Pancotti is strategic advisor for Groundwork Collaborative, where she co-wrote two recent reports looking at corporate profits during inflation and the rise in grocery prices. Liz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I think a lot of us have felt the pinch when we're shopping, noticed particular items we regularly buy going up. When you take a broader look at groceries in general, what are some of the key things we're seeing?
So we find that since the start of the pandemic, since the end of 2019, grocery prices overall are up 25%. And as you mentioned before, that is more than overall inflation, which is up 19%. So I think also just given the regularity of grocery prices, you know, most folks are going once, if not more than once a week, people really feel the increase in grocery prices more so than maybe a used car, which you certainly don't purchase every week and may not have even purchased one since the onset of the pandemic. We're certainly noticing that some items are rising faster than others. I think, you know, a year or two ago, folks really pointed to eggs. Those actually have come down a significant amount, almost 25% since last year. And, you know, milk and other kind of staple items are down. But we find that five items drove nearly 30% of grocery inflation over that time period. So beef, poultry, juice, and other kind of non-carbonated beverages, fresh produce and snacks, which I think that for a lot of people that makes up kind of the bulk of their cart. But people, I think, are really still feeling those price increases at the grocery store, even though the growth in those prices has slowed over the last year.
Before we dig into the causes of those prices, I want to talk a little bit about the consequences. Now, for somebody at the top end of the income scale, increase in grocery prices, they may not feel it so much. What kind of impact is this having, especially at the lower end, though, of the income scale?
Yeah, it's a really good point. The burden of these higher grocery prices is certainly not borne equally across the income spectrum. So we find that folks in the bottom 20% spend about a quarter of their income on groceries, where those in the top 20% actually spend less than 5% of their income. So we find a much larger impact, obviously, at the bottom. Specifically at the bottom, though, folks at the very bottom are going to receive food assistance or SNAP. Those benefits have increased a lot since the start of the pandemic as a result of some reforms that the Biden administration has made. And so we actually find that on average, the typical family that relies on SNAP has seen their benefits increase at more than double the rate of grocery price inflation. The problem with that, though, is that only about 15% of Americans qualify for those benefits. And so if you fall into kind of the missing middle of folks who are lower income, but not so low income, they qualify for benefits, you are really feeling the squeeze at the checkout counter.
Talking to Liz Pancotti, strategic advisor for Groundwork Collaborative, co-author there of two reports on inflation, the causes of inflation, and especially the price we pay for our groceries. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Liz, the big question is, what is driving these costs? I think the sense during the pandemic and shortly after was supply chain stuff, and that was there, a cost of labor, things like that. What are we seeing now as the grocery food costs seem to be persisting a little higher than inflation in general?
Yeah, so we find a couple of things. One, you're absolutely right that those supply chain snarls were certainly present kind of as we emerged from the pandemic and as folks, you know, bought a lot more groceries there when we were all staying at home. Since then, we found a number of climate-related factors have really affected the supply of kind of key grocery items. So droughts in some places and more rainfall in others have kind of affected meat and sugar and fertilizer markets. The Ukraine-Russia war has also driven up prices for products that those two countries supply to the rest of the world, like oil and wheat and fertilizer that kind of lets all the other stuff grow. And so those shocks, some of them have were temporary or acute, and some have really persisted. In addition to that, we've noticed that even as those shocks have sort of moderated and supply is back at kind of a normal level, companies are still keeping those sticker prices high, even though their input costs have come down. And so we find that in a number of industries, those companies are bragging that their margins are expanding as their costs come down. And though they're not hiking prices anymore, they are leaving prices at those much higher levels, meaning that American families are really subsidizing those companies when they check out at the grocery store.
And that, I know that had been floated as a notion over the last couple of years. Some people call it greedflation, but it can be hard to tease out what different factors are leading to particular reasons for price increases. What can you point to say, yeah, this greedflation, this idea that companies have learned that, hey, we're willing to pay more for stuff, so they're going to keep charging more for stuff even as their costs go down. How do we figure out if that's really the factor?
Yeah, so we have another paper, as you mentioned, that we released, I guess, about 2 weeks ago now, where we find that in the most recent quarters that we have data available for, so the second and third quarters of last year, that the percent of price growth that was driven by, you know, labor costs, which have obviously gone up since the pandemic, non-labor costs, which are kind of those inputs like, you know, raw materials and transportation and whatnot, and then corporate profits, we find that corporate profits are driving more than half of that inflation now that those supply chain snarls have really come down. And we notice this, you know, in, we kind of dug into the earnings calls of a lot of these companies. So in the grocery market in particular, snacks is a really great example. You know, if you're buying chips or Oreos lately, you might have noticed a pretty high increase in those. And we find that those profit margins are up double digits. In fact, for Mondelez International, who makes Oreos, Wheat Thins, and Ritz crackers, we noticed that over a one-year period, their profit margins increased by 75%. And so we do find kind of in the aggregate evidence of that corporate profiteering, but when we dive into particular industries, it's really apparent.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Saner. Hi, Randy. What did you want to tell us about, Randy?
So we have a family of four. I have a three-year-old and a five-year-old. And I used to buy organic, wanting to make sure they have, like, good, healthy food. But it was just becoming too expensive with all the bills as well. So we've just gone back to, like, regular items. School lunches consist mostly of peanut butter and jellies and lots of leftover dinners. So we're definitely trying to, you know, budget our weekly shopping trips to like $150 or less.
Randy, thanks a lot for sharing that. Liz, Randy and her family not alone. What do we know about how families like Randy's have adjusted to these higher costs of food?
Yeah, it's something that, you know, my household of two is feeling, and I can't imagine a household of four more feeling the squeeze there. My household of two tries to stick to that grocery budget, and it's really difficult, you know, in high-cost areas and across the country. I think to her point about, you know, organic shopping, going back to conventional is one that we are seeing evidence of companies really pointing to a decline in demand for those products just because of prices. A lot of that is just, you know, that those products are more expensive to make and grow. But a lot of it is just prices up on the whole. And so I think her experience is not an unfamiliar one for American families right now.
Randy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Liz, another factor you point to in your reports, and this is maybe part of why companies can keep prices up even after their costs go down, is industry concentration. In so many industries in the food world, there might be, you know, two, three, or four companies selling groceries in an area, processing meat, you name it, the list goes on and on. How big a factor is this?
It's a huge factor. You know, I think meat is one that most people point to and can kind of even tell on their own aisles at their grocery store. You know, four companies control between 55 and 85% of the market for beef, poultry, and pork. And we've seen a number of mergers over the last kind of 5 to 10 years in those particular industries that have further consolidated this. This not only raises prices for American consumers at the grocery store, but it really does squeeze the farmers and ranchers that grow and produce that meat. And so I think we're really seeing these big players squeeze, you know, families and small businesses and farmers and ranchers, certainly in Wisconsin. It's a really unfortunate factor. And because they're so large, they have so much power to hike prices because families really have no cheaper competitor to turn to. We noticed this also kind of in the retailer industry, in the actual retailers who are selling this food. And in fact, folks have probably seen in the news a large grocery merger deal between Kroger and Albertsons announced about a year ago, which, if approved by regulators, would really kind of supercharge the consolidation in the grocery retailer industry. And so I think folks are anxiously awaiting the response from the Federal Trade Commission on that particular merger.
Elizabeth Pancotti is an economic policy expert, co-author of a new report from Groundwork Collaborative about inflation and grocery prices. She's with us for a look at what's hot behind higher grocery bills and what policymakers can do about it. We'll get into that in just a few. You could join in at 800-642-1234. As a grocery shopper, what kind of things have you seen a sticker shock for over the last couple of years, have you seen some things go back down? And if you work in the food industry supply chain, from farming to stocking those store shelves, love to hear your observations as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with economic policy researcher Elizabeth Pancotti about why food prices have stayed pretty high, along with some policy fixes aimed at reining them in. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How's the cost of food affected you and your household? Are there policy changes you would like to see? Do you have questions for our guest about her reports on these issues? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Daryl is with us in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Yeah, my question is if your guest, your association has knowledge of these horrendous profits that these companies are taking in, what are government oversight measures in being enforced, or if there are any at all? Why are they just allowed to do this without any ramifications?
Daryl, thanks for the call. Liz, you've looked at least some government statements about accusations of price gouging in food. What kind of things are out there?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, one, I'll say that, you know, there have been some recent actions taken by the Biden administration to kind of target this price gouging. And so recently there was a price gouging case of chicken meat packers raising prices actually before the pandemic. So a lot of this stuff just unfortunately happens on a lag. More recently, you know, I think the Biden administration has realized that companies really are taking advantage of American families, and we've got to do something about that. And so you can kind of see that in some of their more recent work on junk fees, for example, kind of outside the grocery space, but, you know, in at auto dealers or bank overdraft fees, they really are tackling these places where companies just rip off consumers. In addition, I think, you know, the Biden administration has really targeted competition in the agriculture and food markets. And so one of those ways is in October of 2022, the U.S. Department of Agriculture proposed regulations to kind of rein in deceptive practices and outsized anti-competitive factors in the livestock and meat processing markets that weaken competition. And so those rules, when finalized, would significantly improve the industry for farmers, ranchers, and consumers. Outside of the U.S., you know, you've seen other countries with maybe more authorities on the books really take this on. So, for example, in Canada, Prime Minister Trudeau told grocery retailers that they must come up with a plan to lower prices for Canadian consumers or their corporate tax rate could go up. In Europe, we've seen actually a large grocery retail chain say to Pepsi, we're no longer carrying your products because you've decided your prices can skyrocket so much, and we don't think it's fair for consumers or for the retailers' bottom line. I think you might start to see, you know, kind of more action and more public comments from the president on this particular issue. There was a great New York Times article about this over the weekend where the administration is really taking on kind of public shaming of these companies. But beyond that, there are more limited authorities to, you know, price controls or kind of corporate profit caps like some other countries have. And so there are fewer resources, but I think the Biden administration is exploring all of their options.
Thanks for that call, Daryl. Barb joins us now in Madison. Barb, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if there is a list somewhere of these quote-unquote greed companies, because I'd actually boycott them.
Barb, thanks for the call. I mean, can we name names that specifically, Liz, that some companies are keeping prices up and making more profits than other competitors?
It's a great point. We actually, at the Groundwork Collaborative, put out a little chart with about 10 of them to show their profit margin increases. And in the full paper, which you can find at groundworkcollaborative.org, we've got quotes from about a dozen different companies' earnings calls where they are bragging about these outsized margins. So it's definitely out there on the internet. And I don't know that we made a boycott list, but you could pull something together.
Thanks for that call, Barb, at 800-642-1234. The tricky thing for Barb, though, Liz, is if there are only, you know, 2 through 4 ultimate providers of a particular line of products, and, you know, maybe they have sub-brand names along the way, and 2 through 4 of those companies are bumping up their prices, you can't really boycott them, right? Because you're just going to their competitors doing the same thing.
It's true. So we actually, in our corporate profiteering paper, we point to the diaper industry, which, you know, I'm not sure parents can boycott diapers. So it's a good consideration. But we find that there are actually 2 companies, Procter & Gamble and Kimberly-Clark, that control 70% of the U.S. diaper market. So Huggies, Pampers, you name it, they're all made by the same 2 companies. Diaper prices have increased by more than 30% since 2019, going up about $6 a pack. Those 2 companies have seen their costs for wood pulp, which is the kind of absorbent factor in a diaper, go down by 25% last year, and yet diaper prices haven't come down at all. In fact, these companies are bragging about windfall profits on their earnings calls. And so I'm not sure that you can boycott diapers because, as you said, there's only 2 competitors, both their prices are high, and not putting your toddler in diapers probably isn't an option for most parents.
Thanks again for that call. Talking to Liz Pancotti, economic policy researcher at the Groundwork Collaborative, looking at inflation, especially when it comes to food prices. Still time for you to join in with your questions or experiences at 800-642-1234. I got a caller who couldn't stay on the line, bringing up another fact here. Tom from Bangkok says, everything that we buy in this country is hauled by trucks, which run on diesel fuel. I think the high cost of diesel fuel is driving a lot of the inflation we're seeing. That is another factor you looked at, Liz, transportation in general. I know there were points in the pandemic or post-pandemic where that was a big factor. How much do you see that playing into food costs?
Yeah, it was definitely a factor when gas and specifically diesel prices were much higher. Those have come down pretty significantly over the past year, though I think there are some concerns about shipping costs going back up, given kind of recent disruption in the Panama and Suez canals, which some folks may have heard about. So I think there really are these ebbs and flows. And the big takeaway I think we got from the food report was our supply chains are just, they really lack resiliency. And so the tiniest shock reverberates throughout the entire supply chain, really affecting the price that consumers pay at the grocery store.
I want to look to the future a little bit, Liz. Now, to pick a product I rely on, a breakfast cereal, there's different brands. Prices went up. They've dipped a little. At some point in a market, if the cost went down, a competitive market, Company A would start lowering their price to lure Rob's business over to them, and Company B would have to follow up, and those prices would start settling down. Do we expect to see something like that happening, not just in cereal, but other foods as well?
It's a good question. I would love for my Honey Nut Cheerios to cost a little bit less, though I find the store brand doesn't taste as good. But it's a really good question. And actually, what we've seen over the past few years is the opposite. Because there's so little competition in these markets, you know, Company A sees that Company B is going to keep their prices high. It gives them an excuse to keep their prices high. And because customers really like their breakfast cereals or whatever they're buying at the grocery store, they can keep those prices high, and they're still competitive with their competitors, and people will still buy them. And so, you know, I think those volume dips in sales have not really realized for these companies, and as a result, they have no incentive to lower their prices to a competitive level. I agree with you that in a perfect market, you know, what we're taught in Econ 101, that's what should be happening. But unfortunately, I think these companies are kind of what some economists have dubbed tacitly colluding, or knowing that one company is going to keep them high and it gives them an excuse to keep theirs high as well.
Just briefly, Liz, on the politics of this, you mentioned some action from the Biden administration. This is a huge constituency, presumably everybody eats. Do you see a lot of alarm and action from the political world to tackle this issue?
Yeah, so actually, I just saw this morning that Senator Baldwin retweeted an article about our report. So I definitely think that local policymakers in Wisconsin and across the country, the Biden administration and others, are paying attention to this. It is a hard issue. there is not a magic wand to wave to bring prices down at Kroger or Walmart overnight. It really requires a harder look at the resiliency of our supply chains, the competition in our markets, and ultimately kind of this corporate profiteering that unfortunately our regulatory and tax policies really enable and in some cases incentivize. And so while I think when we set out to write this report, we hoped we would be able to find the crux of these price increases, it's such a pervasive issue from climate factors to increased transportation costs to, you know, global economic conditions. The whole thing, all of this is so interwoven that policymakers unfortunately don't have a magic fix for this. But I think it is something they know and are paying attention to.
Thanks to our guest, Elizabeth Pancotti, economic policy researcher, strategic advisor at the Groundwork Collaborative, with us to talk about why grocery costs have stayed high even as inflation cools. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Regular screening for colon cancer begins at age 45, but it's growing as a concern at younger ages. Over the last two decades, young people have been seeing higher rates of colorectal cancer. For people under the age of 50, it's now a top cause of cancer-related deaths, number one for men, second place for women. A Wisconsin colorectal cancer specialist is here with us to talk about possible causes behind that, how to know if you might be at risk, and what's out there for diagnosis and treatment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a family history of colorectal cancer? Did you have to get screened early at some point? Has this affected your life or someone in your family? If you're a healthcare provider, are you seeing this colorectal cancer happening more often with younger patients? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Noelle Lacanti is a UW Health Medical Oncologist and Associate Professor in the Division of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care in the Department of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Lacanti, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
First of all, can you tell us some of the basics of what colorectal cancer is?
Yeah, sure. The colon and the rectum is also known as the large intestine. Obviously, everybody has one, so we're all at risk for this type of cancer. It has been going down in totality because of screening. There are many different ways to screen. We can get into that later, but we've been seeing this fairly dramatic rise in early onset colorectal cancer over the last 20 years. So that would be people under the age of 50.
And as I read up on this, I might think, okay, well, maybe we're seeing a rise in this because we're looking for it more, getting better at diagnosing it. And the consensus seems to be no, it legitimately seems to be happening more. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely not. It's generally being seen in people that aren't being screened at all or aren't eligible for screening.
And is this the case where before this rise, you know, this would be pretty a low priority? If somebody presented with symptoms, it would still seem pretty unlikely that that younger person would have some kind of colorectal cancer?
Can you repeat the question? Yeah. So if someone has symptoms, are they...
Like back in the day, this is something that I think providers would not even look for in young people, right?
Yeah, right. And it's still... you know, there are other things that might cause these symptoms too, but we just don't want people to forget about colon cancer. You can see it in very young people. We're even seeing it in teens now. So we need to keep it on our list.
And one of the big open question is what would be causing this? And I don't think we have a solid answer, but what are some of the notions as to why younger people are presenting with colorectal cancer more often?
Yeah, so we know it's not genetics. We know that pretty confidently. It's not like there's an increased rate of Lynch syndrome or other hereditary colorectal cancer syndromes. We think it's an environmental exposure. So many cancers are related to environmental exposures. Colorectal cancer, you know, is no different, but there's not a clear consensus like there is with smoking that there's one overwhelming exposure. So it may be things like processed foods, particularly what we call ultra processed foods, so shelf stable foods, red meats, alcohol consumption, exercise, perhaps being above recommended body, you know, weight for your height. So there's a whole bunch of theories out there. I don't think we know exactly for sure. We just know it's continuing to rise.
Talking to Dr. Noel Locanti, a medical oncologist at UW Health, looking at colorectal cancer. Overall numbers, good news going down. Bad news, younger people showing up with it more and more often. You could join in with your questions, maybe your own experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Locanti, you mentioned symptoms. What kind of symptoms would people have that might make you think, okay, hey, maybe this is some kind of colorectal cancer?
Yeah, bleeding. So blood in the stool or even blood without a bowel movement, particularly bleeding that is persistent. Abdominal pain or unexplained weight loss. So you're not trying to lose weight. You're not, you didn't change your diet or exercise, but weight is coming off.
And then if someone has some of those symptoms, what are the diagnosis methods?
Yeah, I think what we see most often, especially in these young people, is that they have these prolonged periods of working up these symptoms where people are told, oh, it's hemorrhoids, oh, you have an anal fissure, it's irritable bowel disease. And we see these patients presenting over and over again for attention. And as with most cancers in colon and rectal cancer, the sooner we can diagnose it, the better the outcomes. So it's hard to, you know, on the end result, when they finally have cancer, realize like, oh, they've actually been presenting for care for sometimes a year or longer. So we really want people to go see their primary care doctor or a trusted healthcare provider to get those symptoms worked up. Under no circumstances should bleeding be assumed to be hemorrhoids, even in a young person. It really requires some further evaluation. But likewise for those other symptoms like abdominal pain or unexplained weight loss, the right test is colonoscopy for colon cancer.
And talk a little bit about the procedure of colonoscopy. It's something I think people dread some. I've done it myself. The prep is not one of the more charming experiences we'll ever experience, but it's worth it. Talk us through that diagnostic.
Yeah. So the diagnostic colonoscopy, so if you're having symptoms, we have to clean out your bowel, which is called a bowel prep. Not very fun, but a necessary evil. So you take medication, usually liquid form, sometimes some pills and liquids, to force your bowels basically to completely evacuate. So there's a lot of diarrhea leading up to the procedure. Then when you go in for the procedure, it's done by general surgery, usually your gastroenterology. You're sedated most of the time, laid on your side. A camera's put into the rectum and then snaked all the way to the beginning of the colon and then slowly removed. The whole procedure takes, you know, 15 minutes. It's actually not that much time. Most of the time is spent getting you sedated and put in the right position. And then you go home. It takes a little bit of time to sleep off that sedation for some people, but then by the next day, you should be back to normal.
And reports are that I was very entertaining when I came out of procedure.
I
don't remember a thing about that, though.
That's great.
We got a call from Angie in Madison who couldn't stay on the line. She says, first of all, Dr. Locanti was my mom's oncologist, and she saved her life. Also, a question, is there a correlation, Angie asked, between any other digestive conditions like diverticulitis and colon cancers?
Yeah, great question. So irritable bowel and chronic constipation do not seem to increase your risk. There are certain GI conditions that absolutely do, ulcerative colitis being kind of top of the list. Ulcerative colitis is an inflammatory bowel disease, so chronic inflammation in the colon. Diverticulitis generally would not increase your risk dramatically. And then certain conditions that suppress your own immune system. So if you're on chronic immunosuppression for whatever reason, increases your rate of all cancers, not just colon cancer.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Oshkosh. Joe, hello.
Hi there. So I'm calling because I went to the eye doctor a while ago, and they found a cluster of freckles on my eyes and actually told me that it's an indicator for something called Gardner syndrome, which increases your rate of colon cancer. I'm 26, so this program right now, I have questions about it. How concerned should I be about Gardner syndrome, and is there a non-invasive way to screen for it, or is colonoscopy the best way?
Joe, thanks for the call. First of all, this Gardner's syndrome, is that something, Dr. Locanti, that is correlated with colorectal cancer?
Yeah, it sure is. Gardner syndrome is a syndrome where patients can get lots of polyps in their colon. We haven't really talked about this, but colon cancer arises first as a polyp, and then that turns into a larger polyp that then turns into an invasive carcinoma. So yes, patients with Gardner syndrome are at very high risk of colon cancer. The second question, and you know, Joe, I'm not your doctor, so of course you should absolutely run this by your actual doctors, but there is a blood test to confirm Gardner syndrome. If you have it, we generally do recommend a more intensive screening program for a variety of cancers, not just colon cancer. There are non-invasive ways to screen for colon cancer if you're at average risk. I would not put somebody with a hereditary syndrome, though, in that average risk bucket. So I think colonoscopy is going to be the best bet here. Or if someone has, you know, Lynch syndrome being the most common type of hereditary colon cancer syndrome, but there's a number of them. But I think that's an important caveat with, you know, at-home screening. I think all of us in Wisconsin have seen like Cologuard ads on the TV. That's a Wisconsin company. That's really meant for average risk patients.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. You mentioned a Lynch syndrome, this Gardner syndrome. Are there other things in somebody's life that might say, hey, even if you don't have symptoms, maybe you should look at getting this checked out, a family history or other conditions?
Yeah, so family history in a first-degree relative, so that would be sibling, parent, or child, does increase your rate of colon cancer, but also a family history of not just cancer, but polyps, particularly the precancerous type of polyps. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't routinely talk to my parents about their colonoscopy results, but maybe we should, you know. There's also this concept in colorectal cancer screening, especially where people are kind of embarrassed or ashamed to talk about their testing, their diagnosis, and that can really hurt younger generations, because if you don't know about a family history, you can't advocate or qualify for earlier screening. But to answer your question more directly, yes, a first-degree relative with either colon cancer or what are called adenomatous polyps would increase your risk, and you could get screened earlier.
Thanks again for that call. We're talking to Dr. Noelle Loconte, medical oncologist at UW Health. We're talking about the recent rise in rates of colorectal cancer in younger people, how to know if you're at risk, looking at some of the risks, the symptoms, the treatments, the diagnosis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you or a loved one had a colorectal cancer diagnosis? Do you wish you had been screened earlier? Do you have questions for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our conversation with Dr. Noelle Loconte, medical oncologist at UW Health, associate professor in the Division of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking to her about the recent rise in rates of colorectal cancer in younger people, even as it goes down among older people, in part because of early detection of polyps. Looking at some of the possible causes, what to watch for, when to seek treatment, you could join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Back to your calls now. Brandon is with us in Green Bay. Brandon, hi. You're on the air, Brandon. Go ahead.
Thanks, Rob. I'm in a bad spot for my cell phone. I've read that toilet paper and different bathroom products can are made with PFAS. It's a, you know, detectable levels, and I'm wondering if there's any correlation between younger people who may their entire life using a bathroom product like that versus maybe older people who've had more of a natural tissue-based bathroom product.
Brandon, thanks for the call. Now, something like PFAS chemicals in products, Brandon mentioned, also in drinking water in many communities, Dr. Loconte, what would it take to establish if there were a connection between that class of chemicals and colorectal cancer? I don't think we're there at this point,
yeah,
right?
We're not there yet. PFAS is really thought to be an endocrine disruptor, and colorectal cancer is not really a hormone sensitive type of cancer, like breast or testicular cancer. But how do we prove a carcinogen? It's quite challenging, actually, for a couple of reasons. Most carcinogens are not that strong of an effect, so you have to have a big exposure over a long amount of time. You know, the one exception here would be smoking and tobacco, which strongly is correlated with a number of cancers. But most environmental exposures only slightly increase your risk, and most of us are not exposed to these things very frequently. So there's a whole scientific study devoted to trying to figure out exactly how much these increase your risk. People also move around. We can't do randomized trials where we expose half the people to PFAS, half not to. So we do like retrospective reviews where we ask people, well, where did you live growing up and how much did you drink your water and these kind of things. And then we try to triangulate around it, but it's actually quite difficult. You know, there's a few example of these so-called cancer clusters across the U.S., but they're very, very hard. The bar is quite high to prove that.
Brandon, thanks a lot for the question. We'll go now to Joe in Loganville. Joe, hello.
Hello. I just, for one, I'm a 12-year colon cancer survivor, thanks to Dr. LaConte. She was my oncologist at the time.
Oh, my gosh. All my patients are calling in. It's great.
Yeah.
And did you want to tell us a little bit about your... Yeah, go ahead, Joe. Yeah,
we did find Lynch syndrome in my genes, so I do, you know, I'm a higher risk person, from what I understand, for colon cancer. I don't know what else to say right at the moment. Just big shout out to Dr. LaConte. Yeah.
Well, and Joe, I wanted to ask, I mean, you're sharing your story some. Are you hoping that more people share their stories, get the word out to maybe catch things hopefully earlier than you caught your own colorectal cancer?
Definitely. I'm not bashful to talk to people about colonoscopies and tell them my results and tell them they need to get in to get checked. Early 60s and anybody in my age bracket and younger, I'm a big promoter of getting colon. It's, you know, people worry about the prep and all that. And I've had so many, I lost count. And it's not as bad as everybody makes it sound. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, just have some books standing by, Joe. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It does seem, Dr. LaConte, like we're more willing to talk about colonoscopies. You know, we've had high-profile media personalities do them on TV. Yeah. I'd be a little reluctant. I don't know what I'd say on TV. But it does seem like people like Joe and others are willing to serve as ambassadors to get the word out.
Yeah, there's still populations where it's not socially acceptable to talk about it. So you're right. I mean, I think also people like Chadwick Boseman really helped us open up lines of communication. But we all have colons, right? We all are at risk, so we all should be talking about it.
Thanks again for calling in, Joe, and sharing your story. We're talking to Dr. Noel LaConte, UW Health medical oncologist, working at colorectal cancer, in part because of numbers over the last 20 years now showing it increasing among younger people than you would usually expect. People under the age of 50, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Dot is with us in Chippewa Falls. Dot, hello.
Hi, I have a question. For a couple days, I was passing blood, a lot of blood, so I had a colonoscopy and was diagnosed with colitis. And I was wondering if you had information on a remedy or something to take to prevent any more problems.
Dot, thanks a lot for the call. And, of course, you can't really treat people over the phone, Dr. LaConte, but are there common treatments for colitis? And do we worry about colitis and any connection to colon cancer?
Yeah, colitis can be a shortened name for ulcerative colitis, which is that high-risk condition. So, for sure, Dot, you should be seeing primary care and probably gastroenterology to help set forth your treatment plan. There are multiple treatments for it. Most require something prescribed by a physician. So I would not recommend the natural route here, but yes, you need ongoing care and follow-up.
Dot, thanks for the call. Jim is with us now in Mount Hope. Jim, hi. Jim, are you there?
Hello.
Yep, you're on the air,
yeah.
Jim. Go ahead.
Well, as I said, I just had a colonoscopy not too long ago. Had 9 polyps they removed. They said, I'll see you in 2 years. Went back to a different doctor because insurance changed. They found 3. And then they told me 5 years. So I'm just wondering, is that kosher or...
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, Dr. Locanti, when somebody has had polyps, what are some of the guidelines as to how frequently thereafter they have that next colonoscopy?
Yeah, it depends. Devil's in the details, right? Mm-hmm. So it depends on the type of polyp. So hyperplastic polyps are sort of, they're not precancerous. They're just little folds or wrinkles in the lining of the bowel. Those don't increase your risk at all. And if that's all you have, you just need your colonoscopy every 5 years. If you have what are called adenomatous polyps, there's three flavors of those, but they all end in the word adenoma. Those are the kind that can turn into cancer. And so it depends on where they were found, the number, were they flat, were they on a little stalk? So it's quite complicated, but could be as frequently as every year until we clear out all the polyps, could be as infrequently as every 3 years. So, and then we have to factor in things like how healthy is the patient otherwise, how many times have they had these procedures, how was their prep? So there's a lot that goes into that. It's really driven by the doctor that did the colonoscopy.
Thanks for that call, Jim. In just our last minute or so, Dr. Locanti, we don't know exactly what's causing colorectal cancer, but what kind of lifestyle things can we do to at least nudge our risk down a little bit?
Yeah. Great question. Regular exercise, trying to be fruit and veggie forward in our diet. So shooting for 6 to 8 servings daily, which is harder than you think. Limiting red meat, limiting heavily processed foods. So we say shop the edges of the grocery store. So that would be, you know, produce, deli, freezer, but not in those areas of the grocery store where things are shelf stable, where they can stay on the shelf for years and years and years. That usually means there's tons of preservatives in there. I think patients can get screened and should get screened starting at the age of 45, maybe earlier if you have a family history. And then if you have symptoms, getting checked out rapidly.
And very briefly for healthcare providers, do they need to be more on the lookout in younger people for colorectal cancer?
For sure. Yes. We see this where patients get ignored for extended periods of time. So yes, we want primary care, urgent care, emergency room. When a patient, young patient presents with bleeding, we want colon and rectal cancer to be on that list right away.
Dr. Locanti, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
That's Dr. Noelle Locanti, UW Health Medical Oncologist and Associate Professor in the Division of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We talked to her about what's behind the rise of colorectal cancer in younger people over the last couple decades, and how to know if you are at risk. This is Central Time.